It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for August 21st, 2021. I want to start by asking that you stay focused and informed about what is happening to the women cyclists and athletes in Afghanistan. My colleague and activist friend Shannon Galpin told us in our conversation back in mid-July that these women were going to be in danger, and they are. This week, Shannon and her network are working feverishly to get these women out of the country, and a few days ago, she was able to secure the departure for five women, making an agonizing choice as to who would board a plane. So please keep these brave people in your thoughts and intentions as people in the background work feverishly to secure their passage to safety. This week's show is a twofer, and both guests have joined me in the past. Back in 2019, sociology professor Ben Brewer asked custom frame builders to respond to a survey he had designed with the hopes of learning about, as he calls it, the, quote, micro-enterprise, end quote, of frame building. COVID sort of delayed the survey, but in fact gave Ben some extra time to analyze the almost 40% response he received from his list of about 300 builders. What he learned and shared with us is both predictable and surprising. An enigma? Nah, Ben will be with me in a moment to explain. After the break, John Sirico is back to help unpack the $1 trillion plus infrastructure bill. Is there money for micromobility? Is this bill enough? Well, is it ever enough? Anyway, John, who joins me from an Airbnb in Florence, Italy, the rascal, will help us to not only break it down, but will guide us into the next phase. So whether you want to be a frame builder or want to know about frame builders, sociology professor Ben Brewer from James Madison University in Virginia has some concrete answers for you. When we spoke with Ben back in 2019, he'd asked that we get the word out about this survey. And today we'll break down what he found out about frame builders, from how many units they produce, to where they live, how much education they've received, and whether they're actually making any money. Hi, Ben. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today. How are you?
I'm great. I'm happy to be here, and thanks for bringing me back.
Well, it's my pleasure. We need to do this. I can remember in 2019 when we last spoke, you had contacted me about sort of reaching out to some of the frame builders to get input into this survey. And now the survey's done. And so that's 2 years ago. Would it have been done last year if it hadn't been for COVID? Or did you always plan on sort of getting it ready for now?
Well, yeah, the analysis part took longer. I mean, I closed the survey finally at the very start of January 2020. So it was, you know, January 2020. I didn't really know what was on the horizon. And yeah, it just, you know, not surprisingly, it took a lot longer to move through just all the other disruptions in my professional life with COVID, with online teaching and whatnot left me a bit behind. But, you know, I'm glad actually to even mention this with respect to COVID, because in a way, I'm really happy that the survey was completed fully before COVID, because I think, you know, what you would find now would be super interesting, but I don't know exactly what you would do with it or how you would generalize from it, you know?
So you think that today, if you were to present this survey for the first time, so nobody had ever seen it before and filled it out, it might give you different results because of COVID?
I think so. I mean, you know, look, we all know the bike industry has been booming, but also sort of upended, but also has all sorts of problems that, you know, are connected to COVID. I mean, I think of, I mean, interesting, just anecdotally, you know, just from what I see from talking with people and see on Instagram and whatnot, I mean, I feel like frame builders have actually, by and large, seem to have done quite well during the COVID period. So the bike boom seems to have benefited them. But on the other hand, you know, some of this stuff about building, selling complete bikes versus frame sets and whatnot, I mean, they can't get parts. I mean, major manufacturers can't get parts. So some little guy trying to build five bikes a year, you know, has no pull. So yeah, I think it would have made me less confident that what I was seeing in the data was actually kind of reflected the backbone of the handbuilt trade, you know.
Which is interesting. So let's start with how many respondents you had, and do you know what the percentage is of perhaps how many? I mean, nobody knows how many frame builders are really out there, custom builders. But what would you say in terms of the respondents versus a percentage of the real total?
Right. So I had 123 people responded in some fashion. Some of those folks only answered a couple questions. And in the report that I have, that ended up being filtered down to 109 respondents that form the basis of that, for a variety of reasons that we can talk about who got filtered out. How many frame builders are there? Well, who knows? I mean, I sent out a solicitation to a list of close to 300 builders, I think. In terms of people, anyone who's doing some frame building, I think there's actually probably more than 300 people at any given moment in the US, probably, you know, 400, maybe even 500, but that includes all sorts of folks who are only doing just a little bit. So 123 initial responses is actually, to my mind, a very high response rate. That's in the 40% range, which for an online survey, especially when there's no real incentive or inducement to do it, seems pretty good to me.
It is a high number. I think people have expectations of like between 1% and 3%, 10% is great. So 40% is phenomenal. And I looked at I've looked at the whole survey. I read through it, of course, before I talked to you. So let's talk about the geographic mix. Did you come up with where people are basically located? I mean, when you think about frame builders, you think California and then you think East Coast, but were ever all the states represented? I know it's just a U.S. survey, which we didn't say right at the beginning.
Right. Yeah. No, it is a U.S. survey. And I don't have a great little infographic to pop up on the report to show how many states were represented.
And well, this is going to be audio anyway. Yeah, <that's laughs> it would just be for you and me.
That's right. But it's too bad. I can't tell you with a quick number how many states were represented. But the basic answer is that, yes, there was quite a geographic distribution. I'm quite confident, you know, I'm fairly confident, as anyone ever is who does a survey, that, you know, I got a representative sample that's out there. It wasn't like I saw some big cluster of only a certain kind of type of person was responding. Yeah, you know, as you're pointing out, the geographic distribution of frame building in the U.S. is very uneven as well, right? I mean, if you looked at Bozeman, Montana with 50,000 people, you'd think like, my God, 10% of the population is a frame builder or something. Well, that's an exaggeration, but you know.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, but it's unevenly distributed. But you know, when I look across a lot of the different categories that you would see, you know, like geographic distribution, time in the business, years of experience, all that. I look, because I can see most everyone responded confidentially, so I know who the respondent was. It looks pretty representative to me of frame building as a whole. So I think it's a good sample.
Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Ben Brewer. He is a professor of sociology at James Madison University in Virginia. And in 2019, which was the last time we spoke, he was just getting ready to do this frame builder survey. And because we interview and talk with frame builders a lot, I'm really interested in what he found out about them that they don't tell me themselves. But at any rate, how did you categorize your participants?
So I didn't do a lot intentionally. I didn't do a lot of categorization in terms of who I solicited to get to take the survey. I wanted to cast the net as widely, broadly as possible. when it came time to actually look at who responded and who was included in my analyses, the one major form of categorization I did was to filter out larger output shops. And this is a challenging thing because in a perfect world, I'd love to have a survey or an understanding of all frame building that's going on in the United States. But as anyone who follows the trade knows, you know, there's a cluster of larger output shops. You know, I have in mind here the Mootses, the Sevens, the Lightspeeds, right? But there's only really like 20 or maybe even fewer than that of large output shops like that in the US. And I didn't want to try to include them in my sample because they would obviously have a very outsized influence on kind of the averages that you would see. And they don't really represent the typical frame builder in the US. And I only ended up with a couple of those shops responding to my survey. So because it was a really like a non-random sample of who responded, I excluded those. So in my analysis, you're basically looking at smaller output shops that are, say, under 200 units a year, whether that's frames or complete bikes or whatever. So I have excluded those larger shops, but on the other hand, you know, small frame builders, the sub 200 units a year people really are the numerical backbone of the frame building industry in the US. So I feel like what I have speaks to the numerical majority of who's in the field. You know?
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. And I have to say, I was certainly not surprised by gender and by ethnicity. So, I mean, well, you look at the sport, it's representative in the frame building community too. So let's talk a little bit about, because you broke it down and I do want to kind of just do a real quick explanation. You broke it down as builder demographics, business demographics, production output and sales, and builder livelihood, which I found fascinating too. So let's talk for a moment about business demographics. What type of business information did you want from your participants and did you get?
Yeah, well, I wanted all sorts of things and I actually got quite a bit. So this ranged from, you know, number of employees, if they have any, total output, but also things like, you know, whether they own their shop, whether their shop is located at their house, they're working out of their garage or a home-based shop, you know, whether they carry insurance, whether they're full-time, part-time, and lots of measures of output and whatnot as well, and the types of things that they're building and the kind of building, the formats that they use, the types of bikes they're building.
So give us sort of an overview of that. What were the answers to business demographics in terms of who's building? And maybe are they full-time, part-time, and what their output is?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of the kinds of businesses, I mean, virtually all of these builders are basically running one-person shops. So, I mean, that totally confirms what is always apparent, but this really, you see it systematically. There were not that many builders have any employees at all. And the people that do have employees only have a few, you know, maybe a single person who they are in partnership with, or maybe some part-time help. So, you know, the typical frame builder in the United States is really like, I don't know, a micro enterprise, I think is probably how they would classify it, you know, business classification. It's a single person handling most aspects of the business. And, you know, they're relatively, I can speak to the specifics of it, but, you know, they're relatively small output shops, you know, so this fits with our kind of stereotype of the frame builder being a garage-based business. And I don't mean that in some sort of, you know, like amateur sort of thing, but just, you know, these are small scale enterprises. They're not building a whole lot every year. Oftentimes, I guess, building on that, people often ask, you know, how many frames are people producing each year? You know, this is often what people want to know about builders and what their wait time is. And in terms of output, so to put some specific numbers behind that, the typical full-time builder, so people that reported themselves being full-time builders, reported making between 28 and 32 units a year. That's sort of the median versus the mean. And a unit was either a frame or a complete bike. So we're talking about people who are making on average about 30 units a year. Not surprisingly, part-time builders have a much lower output. Your typical part-time builder was only building 6 to 10 units a year. And in terms of wait times, that was actually one kind of interesting, maybe surprise. And this is, you know, a question that you're often asking builders as well is, you know, what's your typical wait time? And one thing that was interesting from the survey is that even among full-time builders, the average or mean wait time was only reported as about 7 months. And the median, the actual middle point, was only 5 months. So some of that talk about people having multi-year wait times and all that, I mean, that might be true for a few individual builders, but by and large, these folks don't have a ton, don't have a very long wait time.
Well, it seems to me that if you are a full-time frame builder, it is also your source of income. It behooves you to get your frames out the door.
No, exactly. And I think all that talk about wait times is a bit of a throwback to kind of the early NABS years when there was this boom, and you know, there was also maybe an incentive for builders to misreport a wait time because it made them seem more exclusive and more desirable. But yeah, most of these folks are, you know, they have a short wait time. They want to build bikes and sell them and get them out the door, you know.
Yeah. A cool factor.
Yeah.
You're going to wait for 2 years. You know what? Yeah. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, I want to talk way more about the survey. We're speaking with Ben Brewer. He is a professor of sociology at James Madison University, and he has this really cool survey, which I think we'll be able to give a link to so people can actually go through it before we're done. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and Ben Brewer and I are talking about his frame builder survey. So that survey got sent out right at the beginning of 2020. It is closed, it is analyzed, and we are breaking down some of it. One of the things we didn't say right before the break was who the frame builder is. Now, I know that this is going to sound sort of exclusive because it's the same thing as bike clubs and bike racers. It's basically a middle-aged white man.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the American frame builder on average is the mammal that everybody, you know, talks about in the bike trade. Although, you know, I think actually that's almost, I think the bike trade is probably more diverse overall than frame builders even are. So it's even more predominantly male and white. Frame building is more predominantly male and white than even the bike trade as a whole, you know, the bike industry as a whole. And certainly compared to the demographics of bike ridership, right? I mean, even if we don't have gender parity in terms of bike ridership and enthusiast ridership in the United States, essentially there are almost no women who are building bikes in the United States, you know?
Yeah, very few builders. And I think I've only talked to one or two, maybe. My husband kind of pushes me to find them and talk to them. And I think that more women might be getting into engineering / frame building, because I look at it as being sort of tied together. Most, in fact, let's talk about education for a moment. These are very educated people.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. Yeah. The, you know, college completion and even advanced graduate degree completion rate is quite high. So you're talking about a pretty educated group of folks, which is also kind of interesting when you think about income and livelihood, because the more relevant comparison is not for the general population, but for people with college degrees or advanced degrees. So clearly this seems to attract folks who are highly educated formally as well, not just the kind of non-formally educated tinkerers and kind of amateur engineer types that we often think of with frame building.
Yeah, know. A lot of them have an artistic background. So they've been to places like RISD or Pratt, you know, places where art is the basis, and then the engineering or industrial design comes next. So yeah, it's always interesting to me. Did you break down whether or not people were building frames as opposed to whole bikes?
I did. Yeah. I mean, for full-time builders, it's pretty evenly split. So for full-time builders, the average was that 55% of their output was complete bikes. So I almost expected that to be a little bit higher. And, you know, I think as a trend, I think more and more builders over the past 5-6 years have definitely pushed toward building complete bikes, but you know, it's pretty evenly split between building frames or frame sets and complete bikes. Yeah.
Mm, that's interesting because of course now everybody's stuck with the same situation of no parts, but I think it'll bounce back as soon as the supply chain opens back up again. Did you ask material-wise and fabrication-wise how these builders are building their frames and out of what materials?
I did, yeah. I mean, I asked, you know, what sorts of joinery techniques they were using and what sorts of materials they were building with. And I asked what types of bikes, you know, so mountain, road, whatever category. Some of that stuff is very, this is what tables in the survey report are great for, because you can go, I've got a couple of massive tables that show the breakdown of the typical builder's output. So I would suggest that people go look at the report. I won't try to kind of like read off the table, but you know, the simplest finding is that steel still definitely dominates the hand-built trade in the US. Though a sizable and probably growing portion of builders are, of course, also offering titanium. And, you know, I got a chunk of carbon fiber builders in there as well, that I think probably represents the overall breakdown as well. And, you know, most of these builders are building fully custom or bespoke bikes. That still dominates the trade. So for instance, like 80%, roughly 80% of full-time builders do all or most of their output in the custom category. And not that many full-timers are building batch or pre-built bikes. Like only 5% of full-time builders report that most of their output is a batch build. And, you know, in terms of the types of bikes, again, the table in the report's great for that, because I asked a number of different categories. But basically my sense is that road or road adjacent type bikes, you know, gravel, all road, whatever we want to call these multiple categories, but drop bar bikes still definitely dominate the output in my sample. Though there were plenty of people building hardtail mountain bikes. And of course there are a number of builders that are starting to build full suspension bikes, but statistically that's not very large. Yeah.
So interesting. The whole thing is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that I also found interesting is you want this to be sort of a living survey. And you talk about, I've never heard this, Creative Commons BY-NC license. What is that?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, that sounds, yeah. If you get the report, you'll see that I slapped the Creative Commons license on there. You know, the basic idea with that, and I'm glad you asked because I can explain it in plain English. I mean, the basic idea is that I wanted this report to be freely available to people. You know, builders took their time to respond to the survey. A lot of builders have taken even more of their time to speak with me during recorded interviews. And it's something that I felt like this report is something that I can give back that actually has genuine value to builders and those in the segment and those the general public who are curious about it. So the basic idea is that the report that I have is free. People can download it. You can give it to other people. You can circulate it. You can quote it, whatever you want. The limitation I placed on it was that if you do use the information from it, that you cite where it comes from so they could come back and see my original stuff, and that I didn't want people using it for commercial purposes. So not that I would expect this to happen, but you know, if somebody took the report and wanted to sell the information from it in some kind of like thing, you know, I'd like for them to ask me before that, because I personally have not one luxury or privilege, I guess, of being an academic researcher is that, you know, this is what I do for my living and I get paid to do research as a professor. So I don't have a direct commercial stake in this. So I'm not selling this report in the way that I would have to if I were a market researcher or something like that.
Got it.
Yeah.
So did you come to any conclusions or ideas about the future of the frame building business?
Well, I mean, you know, I have lots of ideas, and, you know, we could talk about builder livelihood as well, because I think those intersect with
each other, let's,
you know, yeah, I mean, in terms of the future, so maybe we'll, you know, in terms of my thoughts about the future of the frame building community, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts, but there's not like one big narrative conclusion that jumps out from this report. It seems to me like the frame building community is relatively stable in terms of new builders coming along. We hear about people and see people leaving the field, but geez, every month, and I build a list, a master list of all the of builders, and, you know, I'm adding to it every month. I come across new builders on Instagram and whatnot. So the churn is very high. You know, and there's been a lot of turnover in the trade. There's new industry suppliers have come in and whatnot. But, you know, I think the trade is fairly stable, even if a lot of folks that are in the trade, the actual participants are turning over pretty routinely. And, you know, as we can talk about with livelihood, I mean, it's a tough go for a lot of builders, you know, and I feel like what I am seeing, not so much from the survey itself, but just the survey helps clarify that or situate it, ground it, is that I do feel like there's more builders who are experimenting with kind of batch building, small batch production, and intentionally kind of purposely using frame building as just one source of income, but not their only source. So it's, I feel like the field, it seems to me like the field has sort of shifted to having people who see frame building as like one part of what they do, one part of their identity, but it isn't necessarily dominates their whole life, or it's not their whole livelihood. You know,
there's one category that I didn't see, and maybe it was not relevant to this survey, but it is of interest to me, and that is how frame builders are getting their names out there so that people can actually decide, I'll buy X frame instead of Y frame.
Yeah, you know, in the survey, I asked people about their promotional efforts, you know, where they were, how they were trying to promote themselves, whether they were on Instagram. I didn't actually, Instagram, other social media accounts, traditional advertising, et cetera. I didn't actually include anything on that in the report that's available, in part because it was hard to kind of summarize, and when I really looked at the data, it didn't tell you a whole lot. But that is something I should go back and look at, actually, now that you're mentioning it, because I really do feel like, you know, we've seen these waves of frame builders. So, you know, you kind of had the early 2000s renaissance that was around NABS, and there were blogs and photo sharing, and NABS got a lot of attention. But then over the last 7 years, that's probably really shifted into the social media domain, right? And so maybe trade shows and some of the traditional media formats or blogs aren't as important. And a lot of these builders that I'm coming across now, I mean, they first pop up on Instagram, you know? And frankly, I think a lot of builders are using a lot of this new wave of builders. They're even using Instagram as not just purely a marketing thing, but even, you know, they build a batch of stuff and they mention on Instagram that they've got it for sale, and people drop on the line and they're purchasing through that. So yeah, I do think there's been a big shift in how people are marketing and promoting themselves in the venues that they're using, for sure.
Well, it is interesting because I know every day my husband's scrolling through Instagram. You know, now most of his work is up on Flickr, but right. I think he's going to start moving it, because that again, that's that kind of old school thinking. And yet people, he follows a lot of them, like the Peter Weigels, you know, the really, they're still on Flickr, you know, they still have their Flickr accounts. So yeah, it is interesting how social media has changed the way people do things. So I guess the last thing is, where can my listeners find a copy of the survey? How can they get it, download it, and read it, and learn from it?
Yeah. No, they can find it on my sort of personal website blog, which is Hand Building Value, all together, handbuildingvalue.com. And, you know, people can email me directly, and I'm happy to just send it along to you as well. If you just search for Ben Brewer and James Madison University, you're likely to find my email quite quickly. I'm always happy to talk with folks if they have questions, critique, other ideas, whatever. And yeah, I think people will sort of buried the lead a little bit here in that, you know, I think people would really like to go look at the survey to find out about the builder livelihood information as well, because I think for a lot of folks, that's going to be the most intriguing part. And, you know, spoiler alert, there's not a lot of folks making much money in the frame building trade.
Yeah, I don't think anybody assumes that when you sell a $10,000 bike that you're putting $9,000 in your pocket. And if you do assume that, you do not understand the bicycle business. So the last thing, and I guess the survey, you know, where to find it was the last thing, but something that interests me is how you got interested in this particular topic.
Well, so there's two reasons. There's sort of two explanations for why I got interested in this. There's the personal and the professional. I mean, the personal, let me just be honest, is that I'm what's now feeling like a lifetime cyclist. I'm in my late 40s and just got into bikes when I was, you know, 12 years old. So it was something that I'd just always been intrigued by, and I wanted to know more about. And, but, you know, professionally, what I'm really interested in with this project was looking at frame builders as an example of kind of small scale business enterprise, you know, and changes in how people work and the pursuit of kind of passion projects and changes in these kind of work arrangements and all of this sort of stuff. So, you know, there's all this talk about entrepreneurship and how we should, you know, be kind of like producing our side hustles or running independent businesses. And so I just thought frame builders were a really interesting case study in that sense, because A, I already knew a fair amount about the technical aspects of what they did in the bike trade. But two, because they're interesting in that they're producing a product that is offered in a mass market format as well, right? So it's not like they're producing a totally unique, I mean, yes, it's a unique custom object, but when you step back from it, fundamentally, they're producing the same core object as what the mass market is producing. And so I was interested to see how they kind of sustain this little layer of livelihood within this larger global bike trade. So I guess the short answer then is like, I was interested in it because I saw them as these kind of artisanal producers and fabricators, and I wanted to see how they make a living and how they try to find a sort of market niche that they sustain.
That is interesting, you know, because you juxtapose the custom builder with the Trex and the specialized, and there is a connection, because when oftentimes, and I've heard builders say this, that I had that idea 20 years ago, and now it's a production idea. So, you know, there is that innovation that goes on between the two camps. Well, this has just been fascinating. We've been speaking with Ben Brewer. He's a professor of sociology at James Madison University in Virginia, and his frame builder survey you can find at handbuildingvalue.com. Thank you so much. And thanks for doing the survey. I myself just found it fascinating, being a lover of a frame builder.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, thanks again for having me.
You have a great day.
You too.
Ben Brewer joined me from his office at James Madison University in Virginia. Ben's survey is arguably the most comprehensive look at frame building I've ever seen. You can find the survey at handbuildingvalue.com and contact Ben if you have any comments or questions. He's ready to answer. So let's take a break, and when we return, we'll speak with teacher, journalist, and contributor to Bloomberg City Lab, John Sirico. He's got the skinny on the massive infrastructure bill that passed the Senate a couple of weeks ago. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
A bicycle crash is not an accident. And when you find yourself in a situation that calls for experienced, effective, and positive legal support and advocacy, you can depend on any of North America's independent bike law members. Bike Law's cycling attorneys are members of our community, committed to the pursuit of cycling safety and justice. For more information about Bike Law, log on to bikelaw.com. They're on your left, protecting your rights. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. from $39 billion, that's with a B, for public transit, to $68 billion, yet another B, for Amtrak, the massive infrastructure bill that finally passed the Senate is back in the hands of the House to be marked up and get ready for a vote. But what's in it for biking, walking, greenways, and local projects? Let's ask John Sirico. He knows. Hey, John, welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me. How dare you be in Italy today?
Thanks so much, Diane, for having me again. It's always great to be back here.
Well, you know that it was a request of one of our listeners who said, I want to hear what John Sirico has to say about the infrastructure bill. And I'm like, well, he's a perfect person to talk about that. So that's what we'll talk about. So let's talk a little bit about Italy. You were, before we actually hit the record button, you were saying that you see cyclists everywhere.
Yeah, especially right where I'm in Florence right now. And Florence did a very ambitious thing a couple of years ago. They shut their entire city center off to traffic. So all around the Duomo and, the Uffizi Gallery, kind of the main historical center, where cars weren't ever for, centuries, now is completely shut off to traffic. So deliveries are allowed up until 9 a.m. Then after that, it's emergency vehicles only. And then the rest is pedestrians and cyclists. So it makes an incredibly huge low traffic neighborhood. So you see cyclists everywhere. And they've done a huge job. Very famously, the former prime minister was the mayor of Florence, and he used to run around on his bike all the time. And was notorious for adding a lot of cycling infrastructure here.
So is that every day or is that just on the weekends?
It's every single day.
Wow. Good for them. Good for them. Yeah, I love that idea. I spoke with a guy named Carlos Pardo, who's an urban planner in Barcelona. I think that's where he's headquartered. And, that's, of course, what all the newer people who are thinking about urban planning and transportation are looking at now, getting these city centers to be more walkable, bikeable, livable.
Yeah, absolutely. And with Florence, it seems so obvious because, one of the first weeks when I got an urban planning degree, one of the first weeks we learned about the walkable city. And Florence is always used as the example because it is this Renaissance era city that was created at a time when there were no vehicles, which is a bit different than Milan, because it's a newer Italian city in terms of its industry. But Florence, you can walk the entire city, main parts of the city, in about 20 minutes. So just the stretch of it, it doesn't make sense to have cars in the city center, just given its history. So there's a huge pride in preservation here. So it kind of worked in that favor as well, to not have cars go down these, very narrow cobblestone streets.
But bicycles, that works.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I guess we should talk about the infrastructure package. Finally, it got through Congress. And there's a lot of questions being tossed around about what benefits it's going to be for the walking, biking, public transit community. There's still a ton of money for roads and bridges, which need repair, but do we really need to be building new infrastructure? So tell me what the good news is in the bill.
Sure. And I also want to just thank that listener for looking for my opinion on it. I've been doing kind of like a, lip service for the bill for my own family and friends for the past couple of weeks. So it's good to kind of come on here and talk about it. So with the good stuff, it's kind of a glass half empty, half full approach. And it kind of depends on what mentality you take. I think there's a decent amount of good stuff in the bill. Namely, my eyes have been on the $39 billion for public transit. The Amtrak is a huge winner of the bill, getting $66 billion to kind of just finally address this huge maintenance backlog that anyone who's taken an Amtrak train knows about. And also upgrading what is already, its most advanced line, the Northeast Corridor, and hopefully this spurs, more investment. We can kind of talk about that later. And then, on top of that, there's some really interesting new criteria and eligibility for federal grants that I think are ambitious and new for the federal government to be doing. And I would say finally, there's a lot of money for safer commutes for pedestrians and kind of thinking about how to improve roads for other users that are not just cars. And Tucker Carlson famously is calling the infrastructure bill on Fox News Pete Buttigieg's bill. I don't know why he thinks that's such a sick burn, but what he means is that it's a lot of Pete Buttigieg's kind of ideas when he was mayor of South Bend and now as a Secretary of Transportation. There's a lot in here for, you know, kind of complete streets, other users besides cars, and a lot of that's through the different criteria that federal grants will now have. So I think it's some new spending, not as much as I think most people wanted, I would say. But there's also a lot of new criteria that I think is a lot of how cities and states get money from the federal government.
Well, let me reintroduce you, and then I want to talk about something we've actually sort of brushed by in the past and see if that works into the bill anyway. We're speaking with John Strico. He happens to be in Florence, Italy right now for a personal trip. And I do want to ask you a little bit about the travel, how that went, because, of course, touring companies are trying to open back up again. And
sure.
trying to figure out what they can and cannot do. But we can talk about that in a little while. So we are talking about the infrastructure bill and its benefits for biking, walking, equity. You know, certainly the people who need public transportation or a way to get around most are the ones who least usually get what they want. So I do want to know about that. Beyond roads and bridges, and even beyond some of the grant programs that are going to benefit some of the cities, what about public transit and maybe even bike share? And the kinds of things that people who absolutely depend on that kind of transportation to get to work, to get to home, to get to kids to school, are right now not getting.
So there's a few things that can kind of be tied directly to that. Of course, you have the big pot for public transit, which will go to public transit agencies and they can decide how to spend it. There's a ton of, you ask any public transit agency about shovel-ready projects, they all have a ton they want to do. So that's going to go to kind of new projects, new capital construction projects. You know, just in terms of the more vulnerable road users, let's call, pedestrian cyclists, people who have been disrupted by transportation projects for cars, there's a good amount. I mean, you have a new federal program that's gonna encourage children to walk or bike to school, which would be the first ever. We've always had safe routes, but this would be a federally enshrined program to do that and give grants for that. There's kind of like these little, golden nuggets kind of packed into this bill. I mean, it's the $1 trillion bill. You know, for example, one of them is a $250 million grant program for cities that rethink congestion. So New York City is going to, hopefully implement a congestion pricing scheme. It was passed a couple of years ago now. It's been kind of delayed by the White House, and now it's kind of delayed by politics with the governor recently resigning. But this would be a grant program to kind of implement similar schemes in other cities. And I think that's a big deal for the federal government to come out and be saying that. Then in terms of a huge equity, victory, there's $1 billion in the bill to reconnect communities that were completely disconnected by highway construction. So one big sign of that was the Federal Department of Transportation recently blocked a Houston highway expansion that would have completely just uprooted Black and Brown communities. Now we're going to have a pot of money. I mean, it's not a ton compared to what's in the bill, but it is something. It is something for the federal government to be saying that's something that's a priority. And then last but not least, you're going to have new eligibility for federal funding on micromobility. So you're going to have new federal funding for, if cities or states want to apply for bike shares or e-scooters, there's going to be new criteria that didn't exist before. It was always just for, rail or, light rail, train, metro. There's going to be new kind of expansions into bike shares and scooters. So it's kind of how you view what is going to exist in new spending. And then, of course, you have to weigh that with all the new spending on highways that's going to exist, right? So it's these kind of different parallel dynamics happening here where everyone's getting a little something. You know, I think for the first time, non-car users are getting something significant, but car users are still getting a ton as well.
Yeah, of course. So I wanted to touch on earmarks and whether they will or will not be coming back. You know, as we've talked to several people who have said that earmarks are a good thing, that in fact, it's something a congressman or congresswoman can take back to his or her constituency and show that something's getting done on that level, that local level, that, state level. So what do you know about earmarks and whether they will be allowed again?
Yeah, so there's a ton of pet projects in the bill. I would say that also is part of the reason why the Republicans ended up going for it. 69-30 was the end vote. Because, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of them are representing counties that really need infrastructure money. I mean, you have a lot of money in this for clean energy grids, for water. You know, you think of places like Flint, Michigan, there's a ton of money to kind of clean up lead pipes for new broadband. And especially in rural areas, there's a lot of money for transportation in rural areas. So I think a lot of the Republican senators knew they could bring this home and kind of cheer it on with their constituents, which was part of selling the sale of the bill. The main thing now is what happens when the bill goes to the House, right? So the House has to kind of mark up the bill and pass their own version. You know, I've been especially keen, you know, the last time I came on the show, we talked about the Greenway funding. There's not a ton of new spending for greenways or for bike and walking paths in this infrastructure bill, but the House leader, Peter DeFazio, on transportation has indicated that he's willing to shove it all through the budget process. And the House has made it clear that they're willing to kind of put a lot of what they didn't get in this infrastructure bill in this kind of larger budget that the Congress has to pass each year. How those kind of chips fall in the end will really determine where what was kind of left out of the bill, whether it actually comes into fruition. So I would say the earmarks, you have a lot of pet projects in the infrastructure bill, but I think we're going to see the real earmarks process happen in that larger bill that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, says she's refuses to see any infrastructure bill unless they have this larger budget also go through, which will be a challenge. So I think it's going to be a lot of political maneuvering on behalf of Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, and the president himself to kind of have this two-track, you know, how to get pull things through the House. So it'll take huge political maneuvering, more so than getting this $1 trillion infrastructure bill through the Senate. You know, so a lot remains to be discussed politically on kind of what's going to happen here.
So that kind of brings up something I hadn't thought about with all that's going on in the Middle East and in Afghanistan. And now we have climate, and climate is such a huge issue. It's like, if you really put that up against everything else, it seems to me that anything that'll help the climate crisis would be up for people. But clearly now they're going to take that political football and throw it around for what's going on in Afghanistan and hold that as a black mark against the administration right now. At least I believe that's what may happen politically. So what kind of time frame might we be looking at to get this infrastructure bill moving forward, you know, passing what they just did? Everybody's rah-rah, but the truth is no money is been spent yet.
Not yet, definitely not. And, you know, I think the White House probably internally right now, you know, they just came off the high of being able to say they were the first administration since Eisenhower to get an infrastructure bill through the Senate. You know, that's a huge achievement for any administration. And I know Biden was definitely doing a victory lap. And then this week happens with the kind of disastrous withdrawal of the troops in Afghanistan. I would say the timeline, Chuck Schumer wanted to get the bill before they broke for the August recess. He was successful. They got the bill through. Now it goes to the House. I know there's talks of having it done in the September, October time, you know, before Thanksgiving. You know, this again relies on, they need to have the budget done by December. So there's kind of a couple different deadlines here. But I think the fall is when we're looking at what will ultimately be the result of both of these different bills that are going through Congress. So I think it's going to be a little while before we really see the end result. But I do know that a lot of transit agencies, especially the kind of tabs that I've kept, you know, on public transit agencies like DC Metro, the MTA in New York City, they're drafting up plans as if the infrastructure money in the $1 trillion bill is happening, and definitely thinking on a basis that that money will eventually come. So, you know, there's already kind of gears in motion for that to happen.
Wow, a lot to talk about, a lot to break down, a lot to unpack. It's just so interesting that everything seems to take so long and all of a sudden it's here, you know?
Yeah.
Now, what do we do with it? Last thing I want to talk about is New York, because a lot of things were happening. You're going to have a new mayor in the city, and now you're going to have the first woman governor for the state. What is going to help propel New York, which, of course, we always look to New York for what's new, what's exciting, what's happening, what's going to propel them into a positive sort of light? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of negative. Plus, we have COVID kind of rearing its ugly head again.
So I would say that the, you know, Kathy Hochul, when she takes office on Monday, which is really soon, you know, I think we have to realize that it's a, you know, Andrew Cuomo really crafted himself as this new Robert Moses in a lot of way, a master builder. Anyone that goes around New York can see it. I mean, the airports are being renovated. There's been new capital construction. He kind of really very specifically left his touch on every infrastructure project for a reason. You know, he wanted to be known for that. And now Kathy's going to kind of inherit all these projects and kind of have to figure out what to do with them, which ones should advance, which ones shouldn't. There's a lot of reason why some of them shouldn't advance, according to some transit advocates. You know, but I think the main thing she'll need to figure out is how to spend all this new money that's going to come into New York from the infrastructure bill, and also how to implement congestion pricing, which is a huge deal for the U.S. It's the first city to do this, which is a very, you know, London has done it, Singapore has done it, but for the first U.S. city to do it, it's a big deal. But, you know, she's going to really be the one who's going to have to sell that and implement it.
Is she for it?
She's voiced support for it, and she's voiced, you know, generally saying, she said in the New York Times story that came out 2 days ago, she's understanding her position on it right now is what her team said. They're figuring out what their position is on it, which, you know, I think a lot of transit advocates definitely rolled their eyes at that because it passed. It is law. And it only was held up because the federal government, you know, under Donald Trump, you know, President Trump held it up, you know, I think as any kind of political move. You know, it requires an environmental review and it requires all these kind of federal mechanisms, but it passed about, you know, 2 or 3 years ago now, 2019. So it remains to be seen, but Kathy definitely inherits some huge shoes, and especially on infrastructure and transportation, because those are two issues that Cuomo would really want to be known for. And also with the new mayor, you know, she's meeting with Mayor de Blasio today, actually, you know, they've constantly, the mayor-governor relationship in New York history has always been tenuous. So she says that won't be the case. I will be a kind of peacemaker. So we'll see, because that relationship really decides transportation dollars. It's been a key source of why the New York City subway has had crisis, you know, service levels decline in the past. It's a huge reason why there hasn't been reconciliation over things like congestion pricing. So these relationships are really important for how infrastructure money is spent in the state. So we'll see what kind of happens as she takes office next week.
It is going to be interesting. Last thing, which I meant to get to before we talked about New York specifically, was if you think anything in this large infrastructure package, and including the one that the House is trying to implement also, what's missing? Is there something that you think they missed?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think there's a ton of miss. I mean, you know, I think this was not the bill Joe Biden wanted, right? You know, President Biden asked for a bill that was nearly three times the size of this price tag wise. You know, and I think Democrats will say that whatever wasn't left in, they'll try to get into that reconciliation bill. So there perhaps is hope for it. What I would have liked to see more of is, you know, more ambitious climate interventions. I think, you know, having $75 billion for the clean energy grid is a start. And I think the bill should be viewed as a start to, you know, completely overhauling the country's infrastructure, you know, and perhaps it'll open up the door to private sector investment. We saw that happen with Obama's stimulus with solar energy. It's the reason why solar energy is so cheap now is because we poured so much money into it 10 years ago. You know, perhaps that'll happen here too. You know, so I would say more ambitious climate interventions. There should have been more money for electric vehicle charging. Should have been more money to kind of shore up our kind of energy grid. I wish there was more for nationwide high-speed rail. That would have been incredible to see. It's great that the Amtrak will get, I think this will, again, this starts them on this road towards hopefully, you know, modernizing their fleet. And I think last but not least, the public transit is a fraction of what's needed if we actually want to get people on public transit. You know, I made this case on Twitter that $69 billion or whatever the end result is, $39 billion for public transit is literally the amount that's less than what the MTA will spend in the next 5 years. That's just one transit agency's five-year capital plan. So when you kind of think of it comparatively, it's a very small amount. And I think, of course, I would have loved to see more on the greenways, but perhaps that will come in a larger bill, you know, specific money for biking and walking infrastructure. You know, again, there's some indirectly, there will be money from it through perhaps these kind of, you know, new eligibility criteria for grants, new, you know, this biking and walking to school, you know, we might see it through different ways, but I would have liked more specific money like greenways for, you know, for biking and walking.
Well, on that note, I hope you have fun while you're in Italy. I know you are there for a wedding. I'll bet it's going to be beautiful. And safe travels back. When will you be back?
I'll be back on Monday. So I'll be back in a couple of days. So it's been a nice quick yawnt over here.
Right. Well, and right back to the desk, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks so much. We've been speaking with John Sirico. He is with Bloomberg City Lab, and he comes and talks to us when we have transportation and New York and a lot of different topics to talk about. Always interesting. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful and safe trip.
Thank you, Diane. Always happy to be here.
As always, John Sirico knows his stuff and keeps us informed about transportation, cities, and biking and walking. It will be interesting to see if New York City acts on the congestion pricing bill that's already law, but has yet to be implemented. It works in Europe. We'll just have to wait and see if it works here in the States. My thanks to Ben Brewer for his work on the Frame Builders Survey. What a great resource and a fascinating glimpse into the trade. Remember that you can download a copy of the survey at handbuildingvalue.com. And of course, my thanks to you for listening. Oh, I have one more item. We received a product that helps to reduce wind noise while riding, and I'm looking for two people to test it. If you are interested, and it's going to be on a first-come, first-served basis, drop me a message via email, outspokencyclist@gmail.com. I'll fill in the details. We'll be back next week with a brand new show. And in the meantime, I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and wait for it. There's always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit outspokencyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.